The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it's time for another edition of Civics 101, a podcast refresher course on some basics you may have forgotten or slept through in school. Today, how does a case get to the Supreme Court? How do cases get kicked up the chain? And how does the highest court in the country decide which ones to hear? And our guide for today is Behzad Mirhashem from the University of New Hampshire School of Law. Hello and welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
First, a little reminder. Supreme Court is the pinnacle of the judiciary branch. That's one of the three pillars of government. It is established in the Constitution, though pretty lightly or loosely, right?
I mean, it's specifically referred to in Article 3 as the judicial power of the United States being vested in the Supreme Court and such other courts as Congress may set up, basically.
Right, but they don't say how many justices, how
exactly.
Any of that. So from what I understand, there are a couple of different routes to get to the Supreme Court. Have I got that right?
Right. The fundamental distinction is courts' power is called jurisdiction. What kind of cases can they hear? And courts can have original jurisdiction or appellate jurisdiction. Original jurisdiction means, let's say our interview doesn't go well and you hit me over the head with a baseball bat and you end up getting arrested, you're going to be brought to a court for trial. That might be the Merrimack County Superior Court here in Concord. That's a court that has original jurisdiction over that criminal case. Then at the end of the trial, if you're found guilty, you can appeal to the New Hampshire Supreme Court. That is a court that has appellate jurisdiction. The U.S. Supreme Court has both original and appellate jurisdiction. Its original jurisdiction is basically over a few kinds of cases. Say, you know, there's a dispute between New Hampshire and Maine over where the boundary line is. And so that kind of a controversy between two states, the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction over it. But mostly its jurisdiction is appellate. It reviews cases that come to it from the lower courts. It has broad powers to basically exercise that kind of jurisdiction over cases that are deciding issues of federal law or federal constitution. But as you can imagine, there's like tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of cases like that every year. And so the kind of cases that they take, agree to review, generally speaking, are either cases where the lower courts have strongly disagreed. A federal appeals court may disagree with another federal appeals court. You have those kinds of splits in authority. Or very occasionally, if there is an issue that they consider of such enormous importance that they decide to hear the case even before such a split has developed.
Okay. So first of all, this interview better go well, because if I have to hit you over the head with the baseball bat, this sounds like a really complicated process. Okay, so we have original jurisdiction. That is something that may not necessarily be argued in lower courts, but maybe a dispute between states, for example. And then there are constitutional issues that also come up in those lower courts. Have I got that right?
Right. So a case that's decided by a lower court can be decided as a matter of federal law, Supreme Court will hear a case like that, or as a matter of federal constitution. So for example—
Yeah, I need an example.
So let's say an example. Let's say I arrive at an airport from outside the country tomorrow and say they detain me and they say, we want to search your cell phone. This is something that's been in the news recently. And they say, you have to give us your password or we're not going to let you go. And, eventually I feel compelled to give them my password and they look through my cell phone and let's say they learn from looking at my messages that I violated, say, a tax law or I'm like texting my drug dealer and they end up arresting me and charging me with a crime. In the trial court, I would ask the court to exclude the evidence against me because it was obtained in violation of my federal search and seizure rights. So I bring a Fourth Amendment claim in the trial court. And a trial court would hear that and say, you know, you were at an international border, you know, your Fourth Amendment rights are very limited there. We think that there was no violation of your rights. And I get convicted and I appeal and I lose in the New Hampshire Supreme Court on appeal, say if it's in the state court system, and then I ask the U.S. Supreme Court to review that Fourth Amendment issue. Now, it may be somebody else was convicted someplace else and their case had been decided differently. So the Supreme Court, in deciding whether to review my case, will look at cases around the country and see, hey, has there been a split of authority on this issue of the extent of your rights at the border, and decide to perhaps hear that case.
Okay, so one big distinction here is that the Supreme Court has discretion to decide on which cases it will hear. Do other courts, I mean, I bring a case in a local court, they don't really have a choice of whether they want to hear it, do they?
The legal terms are mandatory jurisdiction and discretionary. So, for example, the New Hampshire Supreme Court, if you get convicted after a jury trial in a criminal case in New Hampshire, they will review that case in every instance. But if you say are found to have violated the conditions of your probation in a lower court, they have discretionary jurisdiction over that. They may or may not hear that. The jurisdiction of the U.S. Supreme Court is almost entirely discretionary. They get many thousands of these so-called cert petitions every year, and they grant cert in a small fraction of those cases. I think it's important to understand that most people think of appellate courts as being in the business of correcting errors of lower courts. The Supreme Court has said many times they don't have the manpower to do that. There's too many errors. So they don't take cases just to correct errors. They take cases to resolve these sort of important disagreements that have emerged among the lower courts.
And when you say that the Supreme Court will grant cert, meaning they will hear a case, is that
exactly
the term? Okay. And so which kind of cases are interesting to them?
I mean, I think that there's different categories of cases. Obviously, one major category is cases arising under the federal constitution, First Amendment issues about free speech or religion, Second Amendment gun rights, Fourth Amendment search and seizure. So federal constitutional rights are a big part of their docket. But they also have to decide all sorts of questions of just federal law. Congress has passed the law. There's disagreement among the lower courts about what that law means, say the Affordable Care Act. And so they're interested in important issues of, you know, federal statutory law as well.
Okay, then the exciting part. The case gets heard in oral arguments. Is that what happens next?
Oral argument is certainly the most exciting and most heavily covered part of it, but most of the work of an appellate court is done in writing. What happens is if they agree to hear a case, then the parties submit briefs. Those are documents in which both sides present their arguments in writing. So the Supreme Court justices, and more realistically with the help of their clerks, review all of these briefs. And, you know, depending on the issue, they may or may not come to some sort of firm conclusion about how the case should be decided. The sort of ultimate stage is the oral argument, where each side gets a limited amount of time, typically in the U.S. Supreme Court, 30 minutes, to present oral argument and address any questions that the judges may have about certain issues, that about the record, what happened in the lower courts, or hypotheticals they may have about, you know, well, how would you handle this in, you know, such and such a situation.
And that's when the justices go back and forth with each other and ask questions of the only 30 minutes. That's interesting.
Right. I mean, they can, you know, in major cases, they've certainly given more time. But, you know, in other appellate courts, it's even shorter because, again, the main part of the work is really done in writing.
So then they have these oral arguments, they talk things over, and then the justices meet in closed session.
Right. Different appellate courts, you know, sometimes the judges have already pretty much decided the case. Sometimes they still have an open mind until the argument. The practice in the Supreme Court is right after the oral argument, they meet, have a discussion, take at least a preliminary vote, and then the Chief Justice, if he's in the majority, assigns the writing of the opinion to one of the justices.
And if he's in the minority?
Then the most senior judge who's in the majority assigns the writing of the opinion. Many decisions of the court are unanimous, but in the Supreme Court, more than other courts, you have a majority opinion and often a dissenting opinion, one or more. And then there could be concurring opinions. The judge agrees maybe with the result, but has a somewhat different take on the analysis. So such a justice may write a concurring opinion. And then those are draft opinions, and a lot of times as the case moves along and these drafts get circulated among the chambers of the various justices, coalitions can shift and opinions can get edited, and out eventually comes the final product.
Well, Bazad, I'm going to put away my bat and avoid all the legal trouble. That was terrific. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bazad Mir Hashem, he's Assistant Professor of Law and Director of the Criminal Practice Clinic at the University of New Hampshire School of Law. Soon after President Barack Obama began his first term in office, the Penguin Young Readers Group seized on the win and dedicated an entire book to the 44th president in its Who Is / Who Was series. This year, President Donald Trump is notably absent from Penguin's Who Is Who Was series. And that is true for other publishing houses as well. With a presidential race marked by contention and scandal, children's and young adult publishers are grappling with how to best cover the 45th president. New York Times reporter Catherine Rossman covered the tricky business. And Catherine, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the Penguin Young Reader series that I just mentioned. This year, there are titles on Justice Sonia Sotomayor and Princess Diana and Cesar Chavez. Why know who is President Trump?
Well, in fairness, I think it's important to point out they also haven't done President Bill Clinton. They haven't done George W. Bush. When I spoke with the creator and editor of the series, she said that they don't automatically cover every single president. What they're looking for are people who have narratives from their childhood that show them transcending situations or achieving things in a way that can be inspirational to children and young readers, and they just don't feel that's the case with Donald Trump. They don't feel that his story up until the moment of getting elected president is one that warrants book coverage. And so they're sitting it out for now, as are a couple other publishers, but many others are right in there trying to get their books out quickly for children's libraries and book reports and things of that nature. And it's really, really complicated to decide how much to include and also how to navigate the political climate where Americans remain diametrically opposed often in even what they consider facts about the election.
Have any children's authors covered him so far?
Oh, yeah. There's a number. There's a number that have. Scholastic has a book out from their True Book series, which we, the cover of it was on the front page of the Times with that ran along with this story. Scholastic has a series, a rookie book biography series for even younger readers on Trump. Learner Books has a book, Donald Trump, Outspoken Personality and President. They also have a book coming out this fall called Ivanka Trump, A Brand of Her Own. And then, of course, there's all the reference guides that routinely update every 4 years where it'll be, you know, the big book of U.S. presidents and there'll be a spread on each president.
So how did some of these authors and publishers navigate and create language to deal with some of the things that you talked about as challenges before?
Well, they dealt with it in different sort of ways. So, for example, the woman who wrote the book about called Outspoken Personality and President, she's written a number of books for younger readers, And this is the first time she's ever included a subject matter's personal relationships. She included Donald Trump's marriage, divorce, and sort of scandalous divorce from Ivana Trump. This was something that she went back and forth with her editor about. And this author, Jill Sherman, made the case that, you know, this is what made Donald Trump famous. This marriage and this divorce is what landed him in the tabloids and on the front page of papers and magazines, and ultimately, led to him becoming famous enough to have the show The Apprentice and then on to President. That was very unusual. There was a Scholastic book that I mentioned, the True book, which is one, it's a regular series for them, that covered Donald Trump. And in an early version of the book, the writer had a page in the book called Troubling Statements, and it noted, among other things, that I think, in her words, many of Mr. Trump's supporters during the election were white nationalists, and that Trump did little to speak out against the racism and anti-Semitism and anti-Muslim sentiments that they espoused. And when the book came out, that had been modified significantly. That page was then called Campaign Statements, and there was more muted language addressing some of the controversial stances that Trump had taken during the campaign. So people are, you know, different editors and different publishers are sort of addressing it on a case-by-case basis. And, you know, and in fairness, the question is how much information is necessary for a third-grade reader.
Mm.
But also, what is truth? If you are completely sanitizing a situation, are you giving a full and, you know, nonfiction account of somebody's campaign?
Well, as you mentioned, there are presidents that haven't been covered, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, but also American presidential history is riddled with controversy and scandal, often sexual in nature, as with the Lewinsky affair. Thomas Jefferson was a slave owner. His vice president, Aaron Burr, killed Alexander Hamilton. There is Watergate. How have these scandals been handled by children's authors in the past?
You're absolutely right that Trump is not the first president by any means to have a dark history. And one of the books that we focused on in the story was a Time for Kids from Time Inc., book publishers, a book I think just called U.S. Presidents, that again is one of these books that every president gets a page or two and sort of their bullet pointed biographical information. And when they were updating the book for this election cycle, the new editor went back and looked at all the old entries and noticed that Thomas Jefferson was reported to have grown up on a plantation, but it did not address the fact that he was a slave owner. And so she went back into the text, into that entry, and edited it for the current edition to include a paragraph about the fact that Thomas Jefferson was a slave owner.
I'm wondering now, Catherine, you know, all kids have access to Google. They hear their parents talking. The campaign was all over the news, and they probably heard some things, maybe slang for women's anatomy, maybe other kind of things that were said on the campaign trail. Do you think they have an idea what's going on even without these kind of publications?
Probably. And I think that is, it goes towards an argument of why it's worthy or worthwhile to do a more inclusive report in these books, sort of warts and all, if you will, because they've been made privy to things, and it's, you know, why not have it explained more officially for them? So yes, but at the same time, book publishers and editors have to decide what they're going to put their stamp on, and it's not all that different from what newspaper publishers and editors are trying to decide. What is fair? What is relevant? What context does there need to be to make the facts more understandable to the intended audience? And in a book that can't have that many words in it or that many pages because you will lose the audience, those can be even harder questions to answer. In the New York Times, you can report certain things knowing that your readers are being provided all sorts of broader context in the day's paper and the paper from days and weeks and months before. And in the finite space of a children's book, I think it's harder to make those assumptions. And all of these things especially matter because states that have adopted core common standards are required to devote a lot more of their curriculum to nonfiction. So in the last couple of years, nonfiction and thus these sort of biographies have become more important and more a staple of the classroom.
Catherine Rossman, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Catherine Rossman, she's a reporter for The New York Times. There's a link to read her article, Telling Trump's Story to Children. For publishers, it's tricky. The link is at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. It's the sort of business card you might see tacked on a bulletin board at a cafe or a yoga class. John or Jane Doe, professional life coach. As new agey as the concept may have once seemed, life coaching has exploded in recent years, pulling in about $2 billion annually. Programs for executives, for career transformation or wellness, professional coaching is gaining on therapy in America's long tradition of self-improvement. Genevieve Smith is senior editor at New York Magazine and a contributor to Harper's Magazine. She wanted to know more about the business of life coaching and was given permission to observe and write about a 5-session training course on one condition, that she also participate. Genevieve, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So life coach, I guess many coaches now prefer to just say coaching. It's one of those professions that is often used as a punchline. But you found that's really changed in recent years. So when did coaching turn the corner?
Well, you know, and this is sort of anecdotal, but it seemed to me from observation that coaching really sort of changed after the recession, or after the recession hit, and people were really struggling with what to do next and where their careers were going to go. And the corporate sector was going through a lot of changes too. There were a lot of layoffs and downsizing. And coaching sort of stepped in to help those workers who felt really unmoored in this new economy to find their footing.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of licensing requirements are there for aspiring life coaches?
There are no licensing requirements for an aspiring life coach. Anyone can call themselves a coach and start taking clients and charging money. There are, however, professional bodies. There's one main professional body, and we have seen that the profession has gotten more professionalized. There are more people who are seeking out specialized training in order to become a life coach. That being said, the training is still pretty rudimentary. It's nothing like you would see if you were going to become a therapist or a social worker. It's 125 hours plus another 100 or so hours of real world experience. So it's pretty easy to become a life coach. And really, as I said, you don't even need that. You can just open your practice, start taking clients if you wanted to.
But first, you were trained as a life coach. What program did you choose?
I went to CTI, mm-hmm. The Coach Training Institute. They're all the names of these things are so similar. So the Coach Training Institute is based in California, and it's one of the oldest and most well-regarded of the coach training programs. It started in the early 90s, so it's been around for over 20 years. It has tens of thousands of graduates, and it was a 5-part course. Each part was about a month apart and were 3-day modules each one.
How much does it cost?
It costs, well, you know, for me, I was an observer, so I got away with not having to pay for it. But for the students in the class, it was about $6,000 to take the course. And then if they wanted to get fully certified, they ended up having to pay another $5,000 or so to do the extra training to actually get their full certification.
Well, you described some of these sessions, and there is a lot of the sort of jargony phrases like designed their alliance or danced in this moment or one of my favorites. What would your captain say about that?
Right, exactly.
Some of the things that I would imagine in a life coaching or coaching course. But this language is sort of, okay, I'll go with it, dances between emotion and sales pitch. What do you think that relationship is there?
Well, I think you're right. I think it's both of those. I do think that it's tapping into real emotions and real problems, and that sometimes these crazy metaphors actually do seem to help people dig deeper. But it's definitely also a sales pitch, and it's definitely also a business. You know, the coaches themselves are trying to get clients who will pay them money for this service. The coaching school is also, it's created this program in order to convince students that this is the way that you train to become a coach. So it's really doing both of those things at the same same time. And sometimes it's a little bit of an awkward juxtaposition to realize that, you know, this isn't just someone who's very sympathetic and very, you know, emotionally connected to you. This is somebody who wants your money.
Talk to us a little bit about some of the methodology, especially the things that I guess were very unexpected for you.
Well, I think the one technique that I found to be the most helpful in my own life was this idea, CTI called holding the client's agenda, mm-hmm. which meant that if someone comes to you for advice, right, your instinct is to say, well, here's what I would do. Or if you don't say, here's what I would do, it's say, well, I know you. I know what you want. And those are sort of our two like basic, you know, models of helping people usually. And what holding the client's agenda was supposed to mean is that instead of saying what you would do or what you would want for them, is you really try to listen to what it is that they want. Mm-hmm. And I know that sounds incredibly simple and incredibly stupid, but it's actually a very hard thing to do. When someone comes to you and says, I don't know what to do with my career. I don't know, should I stay in this job? Should I go? And then what you have to say is, well, you know, what is it that you like about that job? What would it mean for you to leave that job? And you sort of push them to come up with the answer that they already have. And that I've actually definitely used plenty of times since then. And I find it really helpful and also freeing as a person giving advice or a person helping someone. It's freeing to not have to have your own agenda, to only want what they want for themselves. Mm.
Genevieve Smith is with us. She's a writer who embedded herself in a 5-session course for people looking to become certified coaches, life coaches. She wrote about the experience for Harper's Magazine. You spend some time in the article comparing coaching and therapy and finding that a lot of people are choosing coaching instead of therapy now. What do you think the appeal is now of therapy? Coaching over therapy?
Sure. I think one of the main appeals is that coaching comes across as non-pathologizing, right? I actually had a therapist who was becoming a life coach. And when I asked him to explain to me why, you know, after doing years of training as a therapist, why he was adding life coaching to his resume, he said that a lot of it was a marketing technique. He could go to somebody and say, hey, you know, I've just become a life coach. I'm trying to expand my practice. Can I offer you a session? Would you come and see me? And it doesn't mean that there's something wrong with you. Whereas if he, as a therapist, goes, I really think you could use some therapy, all of a sudden it makes people, you know, very defensive. Uh-huh. There's a feeling that, well, what's wrong with me? You know, I'm fine. And I think some of that is a little bit of a misunderstanding of what therapy is. But certainly for the average person, I mean, there's tons of people, especially they found that especially men who are sort of more resistant to going to therapy, life coaching sounds great. You know, of course, they want to improve their life and get more out of life. But, you know, and perhaps through that process, they're actually kind of secretly getting a little bit of therapy.
Yeah, I'm wondering, you know, you went into this sort of thinking that there was an idea of people might be seeking. Did you come out of it with a different idea about what people want in coaching?
I don't know if it was a different idea than I came in with. I guess, you know, there's sort of two aspects to this, right? There's why people become coaches and why people seek out coaching. And I was really curious as to making coaching a career and how you sort of went from someone, I mean, clearly if you're going to a coaching school, right, your own life is in transition. You don't know what you're going to do next. You're embarking on a new path. So you're sort of the prime kind of person who seeks life coaching. And at the same time, you believe that you should should be someone else's coach. And so I was kind of curious about that transformation and why people choose that. And what I found that I was sort of delighted by and surprised by was that, you know, the people going in there were genuinely nice people who really wanted to help people. And they felt that they had some sort of skill that they could bring to the table. There were a lot of people who'd had long professions and they were now kind of, you know, phasing out of their main career and they wanted to be able to do something that used all of their built up knowledge over time and all of their people skills and all of their desire to help people.
Genevieve, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Genevieve Smith, senior editor at New York Magazine and a contributor to Harper's Magazine. That's where we found her article, 50,000 Life Coaches Can't Be Wrong. You find a link to read more at wordofmouthradio.org. That is all we've got for today. Thanks so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode from Broke for Free, Poddington Bear, and Jazar. Always loads more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow too with more Word of Mouth here on NHPR.